last evening together. I was watching incredible laziness today. Most spectacular laziness. They're so lazy. And just then contemplating how, what I've been trying to encourage here now is just one little aspect of a Buddhist lifestyle or a spiritual lifestyle. And it's what I would see is the establishment of right understanding. Because when we awaken to the moment, then we understand the moment, not intellectually, but we are with it. But then what do we do with that? Well, we have to make decisions, we have to act, we have to speak, we have responsibilities, and so that's the rest of life. But if we can get this bit across and become adept at it, the awakening of the mind, then there's much better chance of making good decisions and also discovering something in our hearts which isn't so dependent on external factors. So it's the simplest of things. So right understanding is the first part of the Noble Eightfold Path, and it can be explained intellectually, but also it can be known experientially by this is the way it is now. In one of the interviews, which I've quite enjoyed, it's nice to reconnect with old friends. Many of us have long friendships, and developing new friendships, that's a very rewarding part of being a teacher, and the kind of sincerity of people sharing and their determination to try to do the work. That's what I always see. The experiences themselves, well, they're sort of ho-hum. Some are great, some are horrible, but there's something deeper, that spiritual, that hunger for truth, that, the honesty about what's going on in our minds, that's always very, very inspiring. So I appreciated that. But anyway, so right understanding, someone in one of the interviews said that he hadn't heard the mention of a choiceless awareness for a long time in many, many, many retreats. And that is the way I allude to that is this is the way it is now, receptive awareness. Lompo, I think in the reading, relaxed attention, watchful, available, what is it? I think this language is pointing to choiceless awareness. But that's a good word to use too. So I don't think I mentioned it, but I think many of you have done that practice. So I actually was going to come at 1:30 today, but I was pinned down my duvet once again. So I didn't make it. It was pathetic. And it wasn't a strong intention, I confess. But that way of not choosing an object, just being the knowing, is very fruitful kind of practice. And so to do the both, to choose an object and to learn to settle the mind, to let go of the object, be the knowing, sort of a basic kind of understanding it would be good to have. And then contemplating laziness. I do that. I just kind of label. So what's the predominant mood? Laziness. And resistance, just like resistance. But I was thinking, how if you could take this practice and really misuse it, you could say, well, I'm feeling really, really lazy and be irresponsible. Well, this is what laziness feels like. I'll just stay in the hot tub and eat Twinkies all day. So that it wouldn't be very profitable. So, and so Buddhist practice is always bounded or grounded in quite strong sense of responsibility, morally and socially. And the teachers that I've been fortunate to gain some insights from Ajahn Chah, Lompo Liam, Lompo Sumedho. They work very hard. My contemporaries, Ajahn Pasano, Ajahn Amaro, Ajahn Sachito, the nuns, they all, Ajahn Sundara, Ajahn Chandasiri, Aya Metanandi, Aya Nimala now, I mean, we all work quite hard. So sometimes, if you don't see the context of this teaching, it can sound a bit unreal. But I think what inspires me is about the, like, Lompo Cha, Lompo Liam, Sumedho, they've been in the center of the action. And they've been the bullseye for a long, long time. And yet they keep, like when Ajahn Sumedho was teaching at Chithurst, we had a really big building project. And a lot of people were coming to the Sangha. And there was a lot, it was very, very worldly in a kind of happy way, because there was a good project and there was lots to do. But Lompo Sumedho, every morning, just banging away at the deathless. We just kept, give us lots of Dhamma instruction. It was so refreshing to be involved in something quite worldly and exciting and interesting and so on. And yet always be reminded, now is the knowing, keep with that. That was it was a very, very healthy balance. So just kind of contemplating, this is terminal laziness. This is my feeling now. Now we say, you know, when you read, the teacher says, practice if you're lazy, practice if you're sick. Now that can kind of sound like you have to get over laziness, right? You have to practice. You know, if you're lazy, you have to practice. If you're tired, you have to practice, and which can sound quite intimidating or just uninteresting. But if you use the word practice with laziness, practice with sickness, to me that it's just a change of a word, but it has a different connotation. So if I practice with laziness, within my responsibilities, then laziness points back to awareness. Some of the language around the treatment of cancer, the person is battling cancer. I could see at a chemical level, yeah, they're really battling that stuff, but as a practitioner, I would say I'm practicing awareness with the sickness. That's what I'm trying to do, whatever the sickness is. And so it's not a resistance to this thing, but it's noticing, well, it belongs. This is a part of it. It's just part of my a part of birth. With birth there is this, practice with it. Whereas practicing, you know, this idea of battling something, obviously chemotherapy is a battle of chemistry, but spiritually practicing with it, that's different. So if you feel lazy, you feel lazy, but then I have responsibilities and so on. But so if I'm practicing with laziness but within responsibility, then it's okay to be lazy. But if I just hang out under my duvet for 2 weeks, that's going to give bad results, and that's irresponsible of me and so on. So I have to make a move somehow. So I'm not trapped by the mood, I'm not limited by it, but I awaken to it and then see what choices, you know, how do I do it now with this mood? How do I think? How do I act? What kind of mental things do I bring up? How do I speak? It's not a call to passivity or activity. It's not like if you feel lazy, as an example, say, that you shouldn't feel lazy. And you have to overcome laziness. But it's not also saying, yeah, just be lazy, it's okay. You don't have to wash the dishes, fine, you know, whatever. It's not that. It's not like taking a position around social action. It's just awakening to the way things are and then seeing what leads to good results and what leads to bad results. So, you know, some people who are very restless and quite often they don't know how to be lazy. It's kind of not in their vocabulary. Other people really know how to be lazy. And, you know, you could see the two should maybe talk a bit. So yeah, keep that in mind, that this idea of it, Lompoa's idea, it belongs, it all belongs. So that the awakening is from a sense of acceptance, and then if I'm lazy in a really unskillful way, then yeah, I need to give myself a good boot up the backside, maybe, or you know, come on, you're dumb, what are you doing? I mean, that could be very, very good. But I'm just like always feeling I have to be meditating, I have to be studying, I have to be practicing. You hate it after a while. It's this kind of inner tyranny of what practice might mean. But if you just were practice with the way things are, practice with the breath, rather than try to control the breath, practice with the moods of the mind, then I think that is a helpful note for me at least. So kind of going into your own, that tomorrow we'll go back to our different social contexts and responsibilities. And then then you deal with complexity. So you practice with complexity. Complexity feels this way. And it's different than sense deprivation, which we've been doing here. It's got to be different. The feeling's got to be different. So being in the city and having questions thrown at you, and, you know, that has a different effect, has to have a different effect. How could it be otherwise? And then if the mind says, oh, I lost all my peace, well, of course, it was supposed to change. But that which knows change is your real, that's where the real peace lies. So even in like attaching to a retreat, to the refinement of peace is suffering. And that's why something beautiful can become suffering, which is kind of sad. So as things change and morph in work or family or at home, and the mood changes, just remember, yeah, it's supposed to change. And then if you're with it, then if it's going in a negative direction, you have a choice not to think that way, to bring up other states of mind, to read something or whatever it might be, but there's a kind of choice. So non-grasping is also intelligence, isn't it? When I don't grasp something, I awaken to it and then make choices from that. That's intelligence, kind of in a heartfelt way. Let me these generous questions. We'll see what we get out of these. I'm curious about how interpersonal conflict is handled at the monastery. Well, sometimes well, sometimes not well. No, it's just we give it a go. We do pretty good right now, but I've seen it handled terribly. You know, and I've seen all kinds of gestalt methods and all that, but in the end, it's just people being mature and being able to talk. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't work. Meetings, and in general, it's quite good because we have a code of conduct which at least it helps us have a common reference point. But then interpersonal ways of like speaking or relating or doing work, one sees friction arising there. A lot of, you know, the usual misperceptions of, like, say, Amaravati has probably 20 nationalities. You know, and an Englishman is going to understand that, you know, an Englishman says a joke different than a German. Right? And just that can be interesting. So it can be quite challenging, but there is a strong sense of aspiration. But even then, as a community, we're not perfect. You know, we've lost the plot at times. We've never done anything immoral, but sometimes we've had our stuff. You know, we're not. People sometimes think, oh, you know, you're all perfect. Well, no way. Yeah, we're just kind of human beings, doing our best. But there is a kind of, what I've seen is like ego energy can't last very long. It comes up sometimes, but it just is so out of place in this kind of a life that it might be loud for a while, but after a while everyone says, no. So we can be influenced by those things, but after a while everyone kind of, no, that's not Vinaya, that's not Dhamma. That's not right. So if we do if we do go to some excess, then we usually find a balance pretty good. And so far, and there have been big problems, not big problems, but you know, what we're trying to do is we're trying to transplant something from Asia into non-Buddhist cultures, and it's very difficult. People don't realize what we're trying to do here. So it's not simply like teaching a retreat. I mean, teaching retreat's a piece of cake. But try to develop a community who has no references of Buddhist monasticism in a culture that does have no references of Buddhist monasticism, with people who have cultural... You see, what we have these different cultures which are conflicting now. We have Pali culture, so the way the canon sets it up. We have Thai culture, Asian culture, Sri Lankan culture. We have Western culture. We have feminism in Western culture. We have egalitarianism in this culture. So we have this kind of rather difficult task of trying to find our way, because we're not Asian, we're different, but we do respect the Asian folk because they have, you know, they've created something quite beautiful. We try to respect the Pali. So the kind of cultural adaptations that we're trying to make now, it's still early days. We don't know. Maybe many Buddhist monasticism won't take hold in North America. You know, that could well be, don't know. So, you know, I'm willing to be a guinea pig. But I know if it didn't work, I'd go back to Thailand. That would be fine. So it's good work. But oftentimes it's misunderstood by lay people because they hear, you know, they have kind of, they interpret it from partial viewpoints and so they don't really live it. So sometimes it takes a lot of. And one of the reasons such a Smith is very happy to be in Thailand, because he doesn't have to explain himself anymore. Because in Thailand, people know what a monk is, but in the West, it's a lot of kind of education to go on. But you know, having said that, it's really wonderful to offer a place and where men can ordain, and Naya's got her place where women can ordain, and this is really what interests me. I mean, I like teaching retreats and I like making these friendships, but you know, there are lots of meditation teachers around, so there's not a shortage. But this part of the Buddha's recommendation, the creation of a monastic order, that's something that obviously interests me because it's been so profitable for me, and so I've gained so much from it. So to be able to offer that to other people, both as a refuge to come as lay people, but also to train and mentor men in this lifestyle. To me, it's very, you know, very rewarding. That's hard work too. So I don't think we have any techniques for interpersonal. Certainly, in the text, you have lots of things. But what it gets down to is just a group of, for us, it's a men's community. It's a group of men communicating, keeping communication open. And for me, as the abbot, for me, it's trying to lead in a way which is not too authoritarian, but still leads. And so I'm always learning too. But we have very good sangha now here in Thissuron. We had a really good winter retreat. But I realize, you know, it's uncertain. I've been in so many different monastic situations where people have gotten really lost in their views and opinions, and at times it's been so like gloriously harmonious and beautiful. I have read that the Buddha's mother became a disciple. As women monks are now being acknowledged in North America, how, if at all, is this decision being received in Asia? Are any changes in the role of women seen in the reasonably near future? That's a very complex cultural issue. Monasticism, women's monasticism, never reached Thailand. It reached Sri Lanka, but I haven't found a good history of it. And it died out in some way, such that when Buddhism went from Sri Lanka to Thailand, if I have it correctly, the women's order had died out for various kinds of reasons. And when it was reintroduced from Thailand back into Sri Lanka or from Burma, then the women's order wasn't there. So Thailand, Southeast Asia, never had official kind of women's monasticism. China did. So where you find now the strongest nuns' orders are actually in Taiwan. Korea too, but I don't know so much about Korea. So from what I've heard, and I'm not an expert on this, there are, like in Taiwan, there are more, many more nuns than there are monks, which isn't the case in, so if you say Asia, it's a very, you know, Asia's a big place. There are many, many countries with different kinds of histories. So to understand women's monasticism and men's monasticism, you have to somehow understand the national culture. You know, what kind of invasions have been there, what kind of Buddhism came there, and so on and so forth. And certainly in all countries, you know, women are looked upon differently. I mean, it's an amazing world change now in social consciousness. In Thailand, it's a very complex issue, because in Thailand there was a law actually passed that the Bhikkhuni order, I think it was in the 30s or something, that the Bhikkhuni order is no longer valid in Theravada Buddhism. So in Thailand, the Thai Sangha, the official Sangha, recognizes Bhikkhunis who are ordained in other lineages, and they can practice and they're respected. But its scholars have said that the Theravada Bhikkhuni order has died out. And there's a lot of legality there in scholarship, which I'm not that much up on. And yet you will find women practicing as Bhikkhunis in Thailand, not many. So they're not arrested or anything, but Thailand is going through some kind of understanding of that. And because in Thai governance, the ecclesiastical law is embedded in the civil law. So if a monk, say, if I embezzle $1,000 from the monastery, say, and I'm found out, then I'm disrobed by the civil authorities. Right? So it's a very complex thing. Say, Sri Lanka has a different kind of history. So Sri Lanka has now more bhikkhunis who are ordained in China. Now, it all sounds terribly complicated and so on, but somehow these changes, they have to come about. You want to keep everyone on board somehow. So change means there's hurt and there's argument and all of that. And so we've been a part of that because we are connected to Thai, to the Thai Sangha, and it's been very difficult for us actually trying to negotiate this one. What the Thai authorities say we should observe right now, because our order has a kind of special place in Thailand, and we are, as in the Thai order, we're obligated by the civil law there. And then you come to North America, there are other viewpoints. So it's been a difficult time for us around that. We do our best, and so attitudes are certainly changing, but I think what we have in Perth is ideal, where Aya has her own ordination lineage, and I support her. But I am not allowed, because of the Thai tradition, I'm not allowed to officiate in any functions that are like we have what call Sangha. We have legal functions, so that are like legally binding in our order. So I can't attend any legally binding functions that she has. So I can't be a part of ordinations that she has. Now, she's probably going to have an ordination this year, and I'm not going to be able to attend, and I'm going to have to take flak for that. And people think I don't support her. But she wouldn't be there if I wasn't here, right? But so I'll take flak for that, and people will misunderstand it, and they'll think I'm some kind of, you know, misogynist or whatever. And what people won't understand, you know, then the blogs will come up, you know, how it goes. But people will understand the complexity of it and the delicacy of it, how we're trying to do something that is not just mavericks from Asia. We want to be in harmony, and because we really respect our elders in Asia, and yet we have to figure out our way of doing it. So I think that the kind of, we're very fortunate in Perth that this has sort of gone the way it has gone. So it's been a difficult one for us, very difficult. Very difficult for the nuns. And there you go. These are the social conventions that are hard to negotiate. But do realize, you know, how complicated this all is, really. When you get different like cultural values coming together like that, I think the lesson we've probably all learned is that monastic communities will not work if they're mixed. They have to be separate. Partially because I think they always were, in general. In Thailand, the two communities, like at Ajahn Chah's monastery, the nuns' community and the monks' community is very, very different. That's probably one thing that we've learned, the mixture of like the two doesn't really work well. So again, like with our situation in Perth, like we'll have a dana on the 12th for someone who's died, Aya will come. We had a dana for my mom on the 22nd, she'll come for that. I'll go to her place for our gratitude to Parents' Day, we'll share Vesak together. So we work really nicely together. But then I'll have something I can't do, and then people won't understand. But praise and blame, that's just, it's all right. It's just the way it goes. So when you do, you know, just as a suggestion and a request maybe, when you read things which are maybe, I don't know, inflammatory or accusatory, realize that usually it's more complicated than some simple, you know, like if you have a, you know, family disagreement among an extended family of millions of people. You know, there's complexities there which no little simple description on a blog is going to understand. So be careful not to get infected by unkind sort of language. It's not really helpful. These things are working their way through in a way which is historical. You know, it really is. You mentioned that Ajahn Sumedho placed importance on hearing the inner sound or sound of silence in meditation. Would you please explain and elaborate? Thanks. So you'll find in Ajahn Sumedho's talks, and Ajahn Amaro has a book called Inner Listening, is it? Inner Listening. He uses that a lot. So Ajahn Sumedho, you know, his first year, he ordained, and he was pretty much a hermit. He was a novice, but he was a hermit up in Nong Khai, which is up Lao border. And I think he had very strong practice. He's quite determined. And I think he kind of picked up on that sound. And then I think, if I understand it correctly, he didn't use it so much, but he, when we were in England, in Hampstead, this strong sound in the back of his consciousness became very apparent while he was walking down a busy street, down Haverstock Hill, I think. And he decided to try to actually investigate this kind of background, electronic, almost electronic sound. And he started to experiment with it, and he started to hold it in consciousness, and he saw that when he relaxed his mind, it was more there. And so he did that for about 10 years before he taught. Now he teaches that quite a lot as a ubaya, or skillful means. And usually that sound is noticed when you relax the mind, when you do space meditation, or you do choiceless awareness, when you relax your mind away from objects, you just relax the mind. So like many of you can do that now, you can just hear that sound in the background. So it uses the hearing base, but it doesn't, it's not, it's like, it's more like space than the sound of the kids playing outside. It's not like a specific sound that you notice it's changing, but it's more like a background. It has a changing nature to it. And so he would, you know, the way he, I use a little bit, not that much. He recommends that you just learn how to hold it. Just learn to hold the sound for a count of 20. And one of the meditators is saying that it's a very good way. If you hold attention to listening, then your mind doesn't produce so much thinking, you know, verbalizing, you know, thinking. So if you notice that, then you can use that just like you can use space. You can use that sound and try to make it as a kind of reference point to the way things are. Now, sometimes people then look for it, and then they get kind of greedy and they get frustrated. So it's something that you let go into, and then it's a kind of subtle noticing, I would say. And then it's a way of relaxing the mind and staying with the spaciousness of consciousness rather than the objects of consciousness. So if you look at any of the literature from Ajahn Sumedho in his talks, in that book has some on it. He recommends Ajahn Amaro too. So you might you could look at some of his tapes. Tapes, we don't do tapes anymore. MP3s. Could you do some teaching about metta? Is it done mainly for your own practice or mainly for other person? How can one avoid feeling pious? Pious, that's an interesting word. Pious. Holier than thou, pious? Is that? Yeah? That's interesting. Well, the idea of metta is goodwill as opposed to ill will. So it's the basic attitude we try to have to all people, all beings, and then when we look at the khandhas, all conditions. So metta is taught in, you could say, two ways. One is the relative consciousness way, so may I be well, may you be well. May I be well, may all the monks be well. May I be well, may I be well. So you use people, you know, you have lists, you may all... May all conservatives be well. Liberals be well. May all new Democrats be well. So these are the conventional ways. So you can use them. So if you have a political bias and your mind goes towards ill will to one particular person, and you realize that actually if I entertain ill will, then that becomes a bias in my mind. And then that bias will be something that will infect my consciousness in the future. So begin to see that even though ill will might seem justified towards that person, I just read this very strong letter from an ex-monk who was a Vietnam vet by a soldier that was dying of cancer, and I think he got shot up in Iraq, and he just rips Bush and Cheney apart. It was just this most moving kind of letter. So that, you know, you can maybe justify hatred there, but what does it do to my mind? So there's a sense of being careful of ill will, because it harms me, and then practicing goodwill towards all beings, so it's unlimited. It's not limited. Now, that doesn't mean one condones foolishness. It's just more protecting consciousness and the way I relate to the world from ill will. So there's a difference between feeling annoyed at someone and just getting angry at someone who cuts you off in the traffic or something like that. That's just heat. But like sustained ill will, that's a serious kind of karmic intention. Right? Your intention. So if I continually, you know, thinking ill will towards someone in my culture, in my family, at work, and I'm not aware of that, that has repercussions, which then will leak out to other people. And so metta means goodwill, but then on the on the level of the five khandhas, it's more like Lompo's suggestion, it all belongs. It all belongs. So this all belongs. So even non-ill will towards ill will. So I feel ill will towards someone, I say, oh, I practice with ill will. It means, oh, ill will feels this way. It belongs. And then the language, then the feeling of metta can also be developed, and that is the feeling in the heart chakra, which we all feel at times when we feel loving towards someone or whatever. So that can be developed, the kind of physiology of that. And it's very basic to freeing the mind, because as long as we are entrenched or trapped by, limited by self and other through ill will, our minds are going to be limited by that. Now, I don't quite know how pious would fit in there. How pious, I feel pious. I mean, I'm more loving than you are. No. Not sure. But it's very practical. It's very practical. But it's also done in conjunction with the other three of the Brahmaviharas. So the second is Karuna, and Karuna is compassion. And it's what motivates us to... Compassion and generosity are the motivating factors of our social life. The opposite of compassion being cruelty. And then mudita is gladness. So just like hearing the kids playing with the ball or something. It was such a happy sound. They're out of the house and they can... So for me, it's again, it brought a gladness up into the heart. So gladness is the sense of happiness the heart can have with beauty, with other people's success, other people's joy, the beauty of a, you know, when we see the first crocus. Has anyone seen one yet? Have you? Oh, I haven't seen one. Okay, there you go. And it is just, wow. Or, you know, like the first robin I heard at the monastery. It's this kind of gladness into the heart. So there is that. And that's an opening, isn't it? It's an opening of the heart. Whereas if you look at ill will, cruelty, cynicism, all those kinds of things, they just kind of close us down into very self... Not good spaces, to say the least. And we would say that these... And then the fourth of the Brahmaviharas is equanimity. And it's the peacefulness of the way with the way things are, and the four go together because it's an open-hearted peacefulness. So someone is dying, and you say, "Yeah, that's the way it is." And you feel compassion, you feel maybe gratitude, or you feel horror or whatever, and yeah, and that's the way it is. It's this way now. That's that kind of peaceful. If someone's having a really hard time, and I can't wish them, you know, may you be happy. Doesn't make sense. I say, may you be at peace of the way things are. And what can one say? So equanimity is that. But those four, they're a very good structure of defining what we would call as right emotion, I suppose, or liberating emotion. And metta is that sense of goodwill. And it's not liking people. You know, one doesn't like horrible people, but to dwell in ill will is different. So I can dislike with someone, I disagree with them. I can advocate for their removal from office, or whatever. But if my heart starts to entertain ill will, and I entertain other people's ill will, and I believe in that, then that's my consciousness is going to go down there, and there'll be a price to pay. And actually, you know, goodwill, usually you can function better. You have more strength, more clarity. So when one feels anger, no, just knows anger feels this way. But if I hate myself for the anger, then there's a lack of goodwill towards myself. But if I believe in the anger and you know, plot to hurt the person, then be careful. So it's a foundation for enlightenment, we say. It's one of the methods. We say it's one of the methods of enlightenment. It's not the goal. It's the method. And it's very important. Let me just do a couple more before we... Would you please review the different meanings of suffering? So would you please review the different meanings of suffering found in the teaching? So it's three ways. This is the word dukkha. So there's dukkha vedana, and in the five khandhas formulation, the five khandhas define our conscious experience as a stream of consciousness rather than as relationship outside. So if I dislike someone, so there's me and the person, but then there's also in the khandhas, there's bodily feeling, maybe tension, there's mental imagery, there's emotion, and that would be in the khandhas formulation. So in the khandhas formulation, you have this word vedana, and vedana means that which is attractive or repulsive, that which attracts or you're drawn away from, or pleasant or unpleasant, and neutral, so it's a range. And so that's dukkha vedana, in that sense, is just the dukkha vedana of me stepping on a nail, that feeling. Or the dukkha vedana of someone insulting me. Ooh. Or the sukha, and sukha is its opposite, the sukha vedana of someone offering me a ginger lemon tea or something when I've got a cold, something like that. So sukha, dukkha, just kind of basic polarity of our sense experience. Then dukkha satcha comes in the Four Noble Truths. So the first noble truth is that there's the noble truth of suffering, dukkha satcha. And so that's dukkha used in a way of our ignorance or misunderstanding of the way things are, creating the causes of suffering. And that's, so dukkha vedana doesn't have to be dukkha in the terms of suffering. Dukkha vedana can be neutral. It can be unpleasant, but I don't have to suffer in that second sense of dukkha satcha. All of us know that. I can have a cold and whine about it, or I can just crack stupid jokes about it. There's a difference. I can feel cold. No, it's too cold. It's too cold. Oh, this is dukkha vedana. It feels that way. So dukkha satcha, it talks about how we attach to things and create suffering from the way things are. And then dukkha lakana means characteristic, and that is dukkha used in the three characteristics of being or existence. And they are anicca dukkha anatta, impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and not self. And here the word means unsatisfactory, and it means unsatisfactory in relationship to the Buddha's enlightenment. It's unsatisfactory because it's changing. I don't really own it. I don't really control it. And if I don't know that, if I don't realize that, and I invest too much into it, I will get disappointed. And so if I'm looking for what the Buddha suggested we could find as human beings, I should not look in that which has the characteristic of unsatisfactoriness. So emotions have the characteristic of anicca dukkha anatta, or the characteristic of unsatisfactory. All emotions are unsatisfactory. And that's where you get this kind of seeming dead, you know, wet blanket thing, that happiness is unsatisfactory. As a characteristic, but as an experience, it's still happy. But you don't invest so much into it that you feel wiped out when it's not there. So dukkha lakana. And so these three characteristics are always being emphasized in our sense experience, that our relationships and our culture and our society and our emotions and our body are anicca dukkha anatta. You hear that all the time. So those are the three ways the word. So you have to kind of know how the word is used in its context, because otherwise Buddhists say it's all suffering. And it may only make sense if you understand lakana, and you understand what all points to. But the Buddhist liberation was that there is freedom from the unsatisfactory. That was the whole point. Otherwise, there's no Buddhist teaching, really. So when people say the Buddha taught that everything is suffering, he didn't. That's a kind of New Age take on it. He said that which has a nature to arise has a nature to cease, and it's unsatisfactory. And that's a much more subtle and intelligent way of considering that. One more? Which one? One more, one more. one. It's a long one. Okay, so I have heard you mention a number of monks in leadership roles who were an inspiration to you. The only nun I have heard mentioned is Mother Teresa. What is the role of women in the Theravada tradition? Do they have leadership roles? So, again, it's new. It's really new for us, this. Where you'll find the most famous women nuns is in Taiwan. You know, there's one nun. What's her name? Where she flies Boeing 707s, her organization, to one of the earthquakes in Turkey. She does huge humanitarian work. She's known as a Mother Teresa of Buddhism. In Thailand, there are several women who are nuns. In Thailand, they have different levels of ordination. Several women who are very, very famous are Michi Sansanim, and there's another. But it's kind of new in Theravada, those leadership roles. So for me, I am Aitanandi here in Perth. But in the West now, you have more women teachers who are lay teachers teaching now, who Sharon Salzberg and people like that, who take leadership roles. So we'll see how that develops. But remember, Theravada is very multinational. There are different ways and different perceptions in different countries. So you can't just brush it with one thing. It's very, very, there's a lot of local histories. My mom was my main feminine inspiration. So I was very lucky. I think that's enough, huh?